welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Cheryl Miller, who is executive director of the Hertog Foundation, and she recently taught an online course about Edith Wharton and The Age of Innocence for the Hertog Foundation. She joins us by Skype as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Cheryl, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Thank you for having me, John.
Why is The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton a great book?
So The Age of Innocence is, I think, known primarily as a love story, in part because of Martin Scorsese's 1993 film adaptation, which naturally, in the Hollywood way, focuses on the thwarted love of Newland Archer for his wife's cousin, Countess Ellen Olenska. And it's a highly romantic novel. I think it's up there with Wuthering Heights or Jane Eyre or these Hollywood classics like Casablanca. But it's so much more than a love story. The Age of Innocence is also a historical novel. It was written in the aftermath of World War I in France, where Wharton had lived since 1907. And she says that after the war, the only possible form for fiction was the historical novel, which is set either before or after that great cataclysm. And The Age of Innocence is very much a novel of before. It's set in this lost world of Edith Wharton's girlhood, which I think is a suggestion about the title. It gives us some idea of what that title might mean. It's the old New York of the 1870s, her Age of Innocence. And it's nostalgic and ironic by turns, a satirical critique, but also this act of commemoration. And it's also, I think, a novel very much interested in politics, which might be surprising to some. One of the major themes of the novel is the differences between America and Europe, democracy and aristocracy. Edith Wharton grew up in Europe. Her parents, after the Civil War, packed up to live and travel across the continent because of economic concerns. And so she had this roaming babyhood like Ellen Olenska. She learns German, French, Spanish, Italian, and she is interested in comparative politics and the ways that different social conventions, mores, shape us and how we're different. So The Age of Innocence is certainly a novel of manners, of comparative politics. Teddy Roosevelt makes a cameo appearance at the end of the novel. So there's a lot in here, I think, that's more than just the love story that we associate The Age of Innocence with.
We're going to talk about all of that, the love story, but so much more, the history, the politics, what this book says about New York City in the Gilded Age, what it says about World War I, who was the author, is the movie version any good, and a lot more. The novel, The Age of Innocence, published in 1920, starts with an opera scene in 1870s New York City. And Edith Wharton once wrote separately that, quote, the first page of the novel ought to contain the germ of the whole, unquote. Cheryl, is that true here? And what do these opening pages tell us?
Oh, absolutely. From the very first page, you are immersed in the world of old New York. We're at the opera, at the old Academy of Music, which we're told is going to be supplanted by the Metropolitan Opera. This is the new opera house in the 40s. So we know already that we're in a time of transition. And this is a world that's already fading away. New people, quote unquote, are infiltrating old New York society. And there's this sense of ambivalence. Old New Yorkers both dread and yet are drawn to these people and the change they bring. We also get introduced to our hero, Newland Archer. He's old New York's most eligible bachelor, comes to the opera late because, as Wharton tells us, it's the thing in metropolises like New York to be fashionably late. So we know he's a man of fashion, someone who is mastered and believes in the manners and customs of his little tribes. He's also a romantic. He wants to time his entrance so that he shows up at just the right time in the opera when the soprano is singing the Daisy Song, which is a declaration of love. So he can see how his betrothed, Mae Welland, one of the central characters, responds. Notably, the opera is Faust. We're told that in the very first sentence. And the scene Newland and Mae are watching suggests that this storybook romance is maybe not going to be so storybook. Marguerite, the soprano, who is Mae's physical double, she's wearing a white dress and has blonde hair. She's singing of her love for Faust, who has been disguised by the devil or Mephistopheles as an age-appropriate young man. And we know, although it's not in the text, we know that if we know the story of Faust, and Archer does, that he's going to seduce her and abandon her when she becomes pregnant. So there's a pretty big question mark hanging over their engagement from the very beginning, just in these first few paragraphs. That makes the novel sound kind of bleak, and it's actually very funny, especially in these opening sections. Like Jane Austen, Edith Wharton is a master of this tart social observation. She has this description of the old New Yorkers hurrying to leave the opera. Americans, she says, want to get away from amusement even more quickly than they want to get to it. And so we already have also that theme of art and its place in American society. And these people aspire to the heights of European culture. They want their music hall to, quote unquote, compete with the splendor of European opera houses, but they don't actually care all that much about the opera as opera. It's a social event, a place for them to see each other and to be seen. And already that marks out Newland Archer is different as well, because Newland Archer, the romantic, actually knows the opera, and he wants to come at a particular time to have this romantic experience. So we also learn that Newland, as conventional as he initially is, it also stands apart from his tribe. And that's all just in the first few paragraphs of the novel.
So Newland Archer is a rich lawyer, old money New York lawyer. He's one of three main characters, I would say, in The Age of Innocence. He is betrothed to Mae Welland, as you say. And on paper, they're a perfect match. But why are they not in reality a perfect match for each other?
Yeah, so their relationship at first, it does seem storybook. They can understand each other by just looking at one another. They communicate so often just through their eyes. And this is initially a great source of pleasure to Newland Archer, that he and his betrothed understand each other so well that they communicate without words, that they have this kind of intimacy. But he begins to have doubts about this relationship. And in particular, in fact, in the very first chapter, he already starts thinking of an ex, the lovely Mrs. Rushworth, a married woman in his set with whom he, as a young bachelor, has had an affair. And we're to understand that this is a kind of accepted arrangement in old New York society, that these young bachelors are going to sow their wild oats, and also that these lovely married women who are probably not in marriages of love, there are very few marriages of love in the Age of Innocence, are also going to want a romantic outlet. So he's already thinking about Mrs. Rushworth, even in this first chapter when he's so happy with Mae Welland. And one of the things that he wants is for Mae to be a little bit like Mrs. Rushworth, to be worldly wise in Wharton's words. But he's not really sure how this miracle of fire and ice would be possible, in part because Mae hasn't had the kind of education, the kind of freedom of experience that would make that possible. And so one of his concerns is that Mae isn't really able to be in a marriage of equals because she hasn't been educated in such a way that would allow her to be an equal. In fact, the word that Wharton uses repeatedly in terms of Mae is trained, that she has been trained to be a kind of perfect wife. And he wonders, like, can you actually have a marriage of equality? Can you have a tender comradeship, is the way he thinks about it, with a woman who is so limited? And he has these artistic interests as well. And that's something, too, that Mae can't share. He thinks initially maybe he can educate her that in that way. Maybe he can read Faust with her during their honeymoon. But what if she doesn't want that? What if she's just not interested in those books, which means an important part of his life is going to be closed to her?
Into this relationship between Newland Archer and Mae Welland then comes our third major character, and we get our love triangle now. This is Ellen Olenska. She is Mae's cousin. Who is she, and how does she bewitch Newland Archer?
Yes, bewitch is the word. So Ellen is the cousin of Mae Welland. She has just recently returned to New York. She made a disastrous marriage in Europe. She marries a fabulously wealthy count, but that count is also dissipated and cruel. And she has what sounds like an abusive marriage. At one point, we're told that he keeps her almost like a prisoner, and that he is also a womanizer who constantly has his mistresses about in the house. So this is an extremely unhappy marriage. She flees from it, and she is brought back home by the Mingott family. This is the large clan that May Welland belongs to. She's brought home, and she shows up at the opera. And this is initially a big scandal, which is that we are going to bring this black sheep cousin not only back home, that's fine, but we're going to ask that she be countenanced socially, that she become part of that social world. And Archer is initially also scandalized by her. She's wearing this unusual dress that evokes the Empress Josephine and shows a lot more skin than old New York is used to seeing. And in this first extended conversation that Archer has with Ellen at a reception after a big society dinner, we see that they maybe have some reason to be wary of her. The conversation is about May, but it's intimate and almost flirtatious. Archer definitely perceives it as such. He finds that the touch of her fan thrills him like a caress. So Ellen definitely seems like trouble. And yet, Archer, as he gets to know Ellen better, what he finds so attractive, but I also think threatening about her, is that Ellen isn't actually trying to break the rules. In fact, the novel is insistent throughout that she's unconscious or unaware of breaking any rules. She's just doing what comes naturally. She's being authentic. And old New York, we're told, is a hieroglyphic world in which the real thing is never said or done. And Ellen says and does the real thing. She doesn't know how to do anything different. And that's, I think, what makes her destabilizing in a way that she wouldn't just be if she were a bad girl, the kind of woman, as Archer thinks, one enjoys and pities, as contrasted to the nice woman that May is, who one loves and respects. Ellen doesn't fit into either of those categories, and so she calls into question the justice of this kind of foundational convention that old New York City is based on. Like, what if a woman had the same freedom as a man? And that freedom would make a very different kind of marriage, that marriage of equals, which Archer is attracted to, but also somewhat frightened by.
And this question about convention and breaking the rules is critically important because this is a great theme of the Age of Innocence then. This question of social conventions and customs and expectations and propriety and vows and family and tradition and all this, are these oppressive? Do they hurt us? Do they prevent us from finding happiness? Or in fact, are they essential to social order?
I think Edith Wharton would say both. There is an anthropological theme to this novel. So Edith Wharton is a young reader. She wasn't allowed to read fiction or much contemporary fiction. So instead she had to read history and philosophy and anthropology, natural science instead. So this is an early interest of her, and that's throughout the novel. And so New York is, I think, in that very first page that I was talking about, right? Archer is described, you know, as a young man in the metropolis where the thing is to arrive late, and that this is, you know, as much of his life as like the totem terrors that ruled, you know, primitive societies. And so there's already this likening of old New York, which thinks of itself as advanced and civilized, modern. It's actually just like these earlier forms of human civilization, which we think of as primitive. And so there's a kind of suggestion that we can't live without these conventions. They're part of all human societies. And they're necessary, but they can also be very cruel. They are unwelcoming to Ellen. And she, again, as I said, she's not trying to break the rules. She's not trying to be bad or to cause trouble. But she's different, and that's enough to make her outcast and exiled in this society. And she becomes terribly lonely, which is one of the things that brings her and Archer together, which is he is somebody in this society that can understand her. But there's also a danger of breaking that social convention, right? Which is that Ellen, in saying the real thing, doing the real thing, she breaks this convention of the way that men and women are supposed to relate to each other in this society. And she creates this emotional intimacy with Archer that ultimately leads to an emotional affair with him. Again, the betrothed of his wife's cousin, a cousin who has been very kind to her, at least at the very beginning of this novel.
Newland eventually abides by convention. He marries May Welland rather than running off with Ellen. What is the marriage of Newland Archer and Mae Welland like? Are they happy?
It's not a happy marriage. I guess there is a question of his agency throughout this novel, which is he declares his love to Ellen just before the beginning of book two. He declares his love to Ellen, and she tells him, "You've actually made this impossible," in part by dissuading her from getting a divorce, which she thinks about obtaining early on and is discouraged from the family because of the scandal that it would bring to the family, but also because she falls in love with Archer, in part because she sees him as upholding the things that are valuable in these social norms, in these social conventions, right? He's a man of honor. In the very first chapter, he takes this decisive action of he sees that everyone is scandalized at the Opera House by the fact that Ellen Olenska is sitting in the box of the Mingott family with his betrothed, and he wants to protect Mae Welland from this scandal. So he wants to be the first man to enter that box. So he shows in and kind of gives his social support to the Mingott family. And then after that, he ends up being the champion of Ellen Olenska, which is that very early on, they try to socially cut her. And Archer is the person who kind of patches up a dinner in extremis with some of the titular heads of this society, the aristocratic van der Luydens, which allows her to re-enter society. And so she sees him as this honorable man who constantly is self-sacrificing for the greater good, for the preservation of the community, of society, and the family. And that's what causes her to fall in love with him. So it's the very actions that bind him to May, that bind him to old New York, that make Ellen love Archer. And so in some ways, there's no way out of his situation. And so he finds himself living a lie. And there, I think there is a question about whether this marriage is in some ways a means for Ellen and Archer to keep their hands clean, to stay innocent. But it comes at the extent of May, which is that she believes that she has married the man who she loves and the man who loves her. And that is not the case. At one point, he begins to wish that she were dead, that she would die young, and so thereby freed him. So it is a marriage in which there is, despite the fact that they know each other so well, there is a deep lack of intimacy, that they're unable to share things in common. And then there is always, and I think one interesting thing to ask yourself throughout the novel is, what exactly does May know at each point in the novel? She often knows a lot more than Archer thinks.
And she's aware that Archer is having an emotional affair with Ellen, doesn't she? She's fully aware of that fact.
Well, that is, I think, up for debate. So very early on in the novel, Archer keeps asking her to speed up their marriage. And she becomes suspicious of this. And she tells him, you know, "I've noticed a change about you. There's something going on here." And so she offers to release him from the engagement, which would have been a huge scandal. So this would have been something that would have come at considerable cost to her, may have dimmed her future marriage prospects. But she nonetheless makes the offer to Archer. Discussing this offer with her, he comes to realize that she believes the person that he is attracted to is Mrs. Rushworth, who I spoke about earlier, right? The lovely married woman with whom he has an affair early on. So she knows all about this affair, but she also thinks that maybe Archer is still in love with her. And she has reason to think this, right? He's thinking about her in the first chapter. And there's some debate, which is, does May actually know more than she's letting on? Does she know, in fact, that it's not Mrs. Rushworth, it's Ellen, and this is a kind of bluff? She's entrapping him in the marriage because she knows he won't have the courage to tell him the truth of his love for her cousin. And then later on, I think it's also open about how much she knows about exactly what the relationship is between Ellen and Archer. She's certainly aware that there is, throughout the marriage, that there is something between Ellen and Archer, although exactly what that relationship is, whether it's a particularly intimate friendship, whether it's a full-on affair, that Ellen has become his mistress, I think that's left open for the reader to interpret.
She does seem to manipulate Newland, though, with a pregnancy. Describe that. How does that play a role, the entrance of children into this marriage between Newland Archer and Mae Welland?
Yeah. So one reading of the novel is that May is the villain of the novel. I think there's definitely room for that reading. I mean, it's definitely Archer's perspective for much of the novel. And interestingly, it's also a common feminist reading, I think, either because they just love Ellen so much, they kind of see her as the antithesis of all that May is, and so they can't appreciate her virtues, or they also just like really enjoy the idea of this woman who's manipulating the doofus man who doesn't realize that she's been calling the shots all along. So there's definitely room for this interpretation. She does have a strategically timed disclosure of her pregnancy to Ellen. Ellen and Archer, Archer in particular, is wanting to resolve this situation finally. He doesn't want to simply have an affair in kind of the traditional old New York way, which is they're discreet. And they have this, what he calls an ordinary hole and corner love affair. He's too honest for that. And so he thinks like the only way to resolve this living of a lie for both him and May, is for him and Ellen to like run away together. And he has all kinds of fantastical notions of what this might be like. Maybe they'll go to Japan or India. And so when this relationship is kind of meeting that kind of heightened moment of drama, of possibility, May has a long talk with Ellen in which she apparently discloses her pregnancy or her suspected pregnancy to Ellen. And shortly thereafter, Ellen writes a note saying, guess what, I'm going back to Europe. And in fact, the family makes possible her return to Paris, where she had lived before, independent of her husband, which is a really important thing. Before, the family had been encouraging her to go back to her husband and remain a married woman, which she refuses to do. So there definitely seems to be some conspiring going on. They hold this dinner for Ellen as a going away event for her, May does. And Archer comes to realize that everyone has known about this relationship, or he believes that they've known about this relationship, that they suspect that she is his mistress. And this is the way of exiling their kinswoman from the tribe, right? This is a kind of tribal ceremony of exclusion that he is party to. And after the dinner, May tells Archer that she is pregnant, which then forecloses the possibility that he can follow Ellen to Europe and run away with her. And so definitely there are people who read that and see this, you know, as manipulative, again, this act of the villain who forecloses the possibility for the lovers to be together. I'm more pro Team May than that. I think we have to remember this is right, the 1870s New York. She can't exactly go to the drugstore and pick up a pregnancy test, right? The signs of this are a little more ambiguous. And certainly Edith Wharton gives us a lot of clues throughout book two that May is pregnant. I mean, in some ways, they're so obvious that you can't believe that Archer doesn't realize them for what they are. Like, she's described as glowing. She's tired and listless at times. There's been kind of a change in her attitude. At one point, he sees her and he thinks, she's gotten kind of heavy, as though his, you know, young wife in her 20s is packing on the pounds. It's like, come on, buddy. So I'm more sympathetic to her and her means to keep Archer in the relationship. And interestingly, they go on and they have three children. And there's this extraordinary closing chapter where we get a reassessment of their relationship and marriage. And one of the things that we're told is that May, of course, knew about the affair, but she also understands it in a different way than Archer initially thinks, which is, as his young son Dallas tells him, that on her deathbed, she tells Archer that she knew that the children would be safe with him because when she asked him to, he gave up the thing he most wanted. There actually is a kind of intimacy all along. She understands that the affair is not just a kind of like crush or infatuation. She actually understands the meaning of it for Archer.
See, I don't see her as a villain. I don't quite see her as a victim, although I do see her as a kind of enforcer of social convention in its most positive form. She's a defender of the family and is trying to keep her family together, intact, from its earliest moments, fighting against a husband who is not totally with her.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. She is constantly compared to Diana, the Greek goddess, who's the huntress. You could go a lot of different places with that. But one of the things that Diana is, she's the patron goddess of childbirth. I do think, though, that yes, May in that moment is the protector of the family, of stability. She's not simply that, right? She does make the offer to Archer to break off the engagement, which would be a major break of social norms. I'm trying to explain this to the students, and like think of like Charles and Diana. If you watch The Crown, it's kind of like that, right? It's going to be in all the newspapers. Everyone's going to be talking about it. So, and she makes the offer to Archer kind of based on the same principle that Ellen gives to Archer about why they can't break off the affair and run away together, which is I can't base my happiness on an injustice or an unhappiness to someone else. And so the principle goes both ways.
Cheryl, you mentioned earlier that we get a cameo appearance from Theodore Roosevelt in this novel. What is he doing here?
Yeah, so he shows up in the very last chapter. And their book two closes with this dinner in which Ellen is exiled. She goes back to Paris. The lovers are separated. And we open up with this final chapter in which Newland Archer is now 57 years old. I think, interestingly, the same age that Edith Wharton was when she wrote this book. And he is in his New York library, and he's reflecting on his life. He's kind of assessing his life. What kind of life has he had? And he thinks about his children. He thinks the real things of his life happened in this library. And one of those real things, one consolation, is the friendship of Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt was a friend of Edith Wharton's. He was also related to her. This old New York is an aristocratic clan, and like everyone is cousins. So she's somehow a cousin to him somewhere on the family tree. And she herself was friends with Roosevelt. He died shortly before she started working on this novel. So his inclusion is in some ways kind of part of the elegiac tone of the novel. Again, this lost world of her youth. But Teddy Roosevelt shows up, and he encourages Archer to get involved in public affairs, in fact, to stand for state assembly, which is something that Archer is encouraged to do earlier in the novel by a journalist and kind of frustrated artist, Ned Winsett. And, you know, you've got to roll up your sleeves and get down into the muck. And Archer, when this advice comes from Ned Winsett, Archer isn't so keen on it. But when it comes from Teddy Roosevelt, a man who lives his advice, who's a contemporary of Archer's, really, and who's part of his society, it becomes much more compelling. Kind of call to political responsibility in the book, which is that, right, old New York society politics was pretty dirty, right? This is the age of Boss Tweed. And so there's a desire to kind of keep yourself innocent, to keep your hands clean. And Edith Wharton is saying, like, you can't do that. What is your responsibility as an elite? What is wealth? What is leisure? What is privilege for you to stand for something, to make a contribution to your society? And so Archer is called to that and becomes a good citizen. I think it's also a call to international responsibility. Again, this book was written in the aftermath of World War I. Both Edith Wharton and Teddy Roosevelt deplored the fact that the United States did not enter the war sooner. They saw it as a mark of great dishonor, also a betrayal of its friendship with France, which is where Edith Wharton was living. And she was very involved in relief efforts for French civilians and wounded French soldiers during that time. So she sees, right, in this aftermath of World War I, there's a sense of like America wants to retreat. Like, we don't want to get messed up or get involved in these messes again. Like, let, you know, Europe deal with itself. And she's saying again, like, we're in this interconnected world, this globalized world. There's this technological profusion in this last chapter. We've got the long distance telephone. We've got steamers that cross the Atlantic in 5 days. We can't just hide behind our shores anymore. We have to be engaged with the world. So there's a kind of call both to the elite for political responsibility, but also for America for responsibility, kind of global responsibility, a leadership role.
Cheryl, The Age of Innocence was made into a movie in 1993, starring Daniel Day-Lewis, Winona Ryder, Michelle Pfeiffer. Great cast, directed by Martin Scorsese. I saw it at the time and really enjoyed it. Is it a good movie? Is it true to the book?
Yeah, it's very faithful to the book. In fact, in terms of the recreation of the period detail, it's really excellent. Wharton incorporates real life events. Characters are based on real life people, and the performances that happen in the book, like this performance of Faust, is based on a real performance of Faust that she saw as a young girl. Scorsese has done extraordinary research into the period to recreate that world for us. So if you want to really immerse yourself in it, the movie is a great way to do that. I also think it's a very ambitious movie. One of the challenges for a movie is to capture interiority. That's for true of any adaptation of a novel. But this narrative is in particular really difficult because it's doing so many things. There's a kind of ironical voice of Wharton, the narrator, who introduces us to this society, analyzes the society, which is also blended into Newland Archer's own voice. And how do you capture that? And Scorsese tries all kinds of tricks to do it, right? I mean, he has a narrator who literally reads some of Edith Wharton's text to give us an understanding of that society. He tries different tricks with cameras. Like, for example, in that first opera scene, we see it as though the camera is an opera glass to give us that sense of being surveilled, of being watched. I think it's a really interesting adaptation. It's a challenging book to adapt. It's not entirely successful as a movie, but I do appreciate its ambition in trying to really capture this really wonderful novel.
How did you discover Edith Wharton and The Age of Innocence as a reader?
Yeah, I wish I actually had a better story about this. But it's just a book that I picked up off a shelf in high school, not knowing anything about it. And I just fell in love with it. And I keep rereading it and rereading it. And obviously reading more of Edith Wharton's work and wonderful biographies of her by Hermione Lee and R.W.B. Lewis. Just getting myself totally steeped in Whartoniana. But I have like a great origin story about why Edith Wharton. It was just chance, contingency.
Let's wrap up with one more question. How then did you come to teach a course on it for the Hertog Foundation? And tell us a little bit about what is the Hertog Foundation? What are you doing? How can our listeners learn more about it and maybe take one of these courses? But what did you do in the course? And then finally, just wrap up for us, what is the case for reading this book today in the 2020s? It's more than a century old. Why read it now?
The Hertog Foundation is a educational philanthropy, and we sponsor programs primarily for undergraduates and recent graduates, but also young professionals. We do them online and in person. And one of the programs that we started was called Humanities at Hertog, which is an online program where students get to read great works of literature in a seminar discussion setting with at least a passionate teacher, I'll say, in my case. Most of my students actually didn't know very much about Edith Wharton or about this novel. So I kind of had to make the case to them about why they might want to read it today. And so one of the things that I told them, which is like a lot of, especially young conservatives, but a lot of students are thinking about like the liberty and order and stability. How do those two things go together? How might we balance them? There's a big question of what the elite owes to the rest of society, right? This question of the 1% or the privilege, right? I think is the word that we use often. This novel is an interrogation, an investigation of that. A lot of my students are really interested in Tocqueville. And I think that this is an extremely Tocquevillian novel. Again, those questions of America and Europe, of democracy and aristocracy, the way that we're formed by social mores. So if you like Tocqueville, you're going to like Edith Wharton. That's the case I make to the students about why I read Edith Wharton today.
Cheryl Miller, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton.
Hey, thank you so much, John.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is at heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.